Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of G. Edward Griffin, who I guess I've known for 45 years or so when he came to my home in December of 1945, and we've been friends ever since then. Ed certainly has written extensively his book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. We, quite frankly, can't keep it in stock. Right now it's out of print, but hopefully it's going to be back in print very, very soon. Good evening, Ed. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Stan. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. When will that your book be available again?
Well, it's in print now. It's already been printed at the printer, so it's on its way to us from Michigan. So
all right, fine. Well, we were actually putting out about 20 of those a week before they disappeared from stock, so we're really looking forward to getting it back. And I know people all across America, all across the world were ordering that book, and it's really the story of what's going on financially in the world, and certainly tying this into Cecil Rhodes and Professor Carol Quigley and this whole move towards world government that, of course, has led us to where we are today. But what did you want to talk about tonight, Ed?
Well, I was hoping that you would lead the way so I could follow.
All right. Well, I was hoping you'd lead the way. Well, first of all, I think...
Here we are leading each other. We're going in circles.
I think that probably the most significant thing really is for people to understand that nothing is as it appears to be. That we hear about Republicans and Democrats, right, left, conservative, liberals, and that's all of a lot of fol-de-rol. If you look at our political candidates today, John McCain and Hillary and Obama... Barack Obama, they're all globalists, they're all dedicated to world government, they're all dedicated to the North American Union, they're all really in favor of big government and ever more government control over our lives, and Obama may talk about change, and Hillary may talk about helping people, and McCain may talk about the fact that, you know, he was a prisoner of war, and he really understands, you know, what it is to give everything for a man's country and how much he loves America, but they're all basically controlled by the internationalists who have a different vision of the world. And of course, our knowledge of that really came about because of a professor named Carol Quigley. He was a man who taught at Princeton and Harvard and then went to Georgetown University, where he met his most famous student, a young man named William Jefferson Clinton. But we're indebted to Carol Quigley, even though he was a way out liberal, and he really didn't agree with most of what we would talk about. We are indebted to him because, of course, he gave us a tremendous insight into the background of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government, but where it really came from. So, with that as the background, why don't you tell us a little bit about Professor Quigley, what he told us, and how this fits into really everything that's going on today, whether it be having to do with the economy, whether it would have to do with, of course, the wars we go into, the no-win wars, and, of course, then, well, certainly what's happening today in America.
Well, Stan, you're quite right. Everything can be understood more clearly with an understanding of what Quigley wrote about and who he was and what his perception was. And by the way, I'm sure your listeners know by now, if they're return listeners, that you yourself are probably the most authority on this man and what he wrote. And so anything I can add to it is almost like an amen rather than a sermon itself. But I can tell you what I tell audiences when I have a chance to address them, and maybe you have some new listeners that will find this interesting.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Yes, all right.
Go right ahead.
Oh, all right. I can say that, as you just mentioned, that Carol Quigley was a professor of history at Georgetown University, and his perhaps most famous student was Bill Clinton, who later became president of the United States, and they formed a rather close relationship while Clinton was there, and a lot of this came out later. We didn't know it at the time, but when Clinton accepted the nomination for president on the Democratic ticket, in his acceptance speech, he mentioned Professor Quigley, who he had studied under 27 years earlier, and paid homage to him. And after he was elected president, in several of his speeches, he again mentioned Professor Quigley and said what a profound impact that this man had had on his thinking and his political direction. And, you know, that's kind of a curious thing to mention a person's college professor 27 years earlier. So, you know, it was a rather intense relationship that they must have had. Most people didn't understand what Clinton was really saying. They thought, well, he's just mentioning a kindly old professor that had a profound impact on his thinking, and isn't that nice? But those who understood who Quigley was and what he wrote about, they knew that this was a hidden message. This meant something entirely different. So who was Quigley and what did he write about? Well, he was the official historian of a conspiracy. And he doesn't call it a conspiracy, but he definitely calls it a secret society. A secret society whose goal it was to take over domination of the world and to control it from behind the scenes. Now, most people would say that's a conspiracy. But anyway, he wrote about this group, the secret society, in two of his books. One was Tragedy and Hope, and the other one was The Anglo-American Establishment. And everyone recognized that Quigley was the authority of this secret society, which was formed by Cecil Rhodes about the turn of the last century. And they understood that he was the expert on it. And they also understood that Quigley was very friendly to it. He had no aversion to it, he said. He admired it. He was given access to its private records, he said, for quite a few years. He knew the people. He knew a lot about it, and he admired it. He said the only difference of opinion he had was that it wished to remain secret. And he felt that their accomplishments were sufficiently impressive and important that they ought to now go public with their identity and with their plan.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ed Griffin was just talking a little bit about Professor Quigley. In fact, the fact that Professor Quigley had been Bill Clinton's mentor, and Bill Clinton, after he became president, had mentioned Professor Quigley several times, and Ed feels that the fact that Bill Clinton mentioned Quigley as often as he did was sort of a secret message to people. Now, what was that message?
Well,
Professor Quigley had written about a secret society. And he wrote about this secret society, said that he was really in total agreement with him. His only disagreement with this secret society was the fact that they wanted to remain secret, and he thought that their wonderful accomplishments should be known to everybody. So you pick up the story there, Ed.
Well, yes, and so anybody who knew what Quigley had written about and what his position was with regard to this secret society, they knew then that Clinton was giving a rather hidden message to the world. So those who understood, Clinton was saying, I know about this secret society, and I am now in its service. And not many people understood that, because not many people really understood who Quigley was and what he wrote about. They hadn't read his books. Well, of course, we know that Clinton himself was a Rhodes Scholar, and that's not surprising when we understand that the secret society about which we're speaking was actually formed by Cecil Rhodes. And Quigley wrote a great deal about this secret society and the wills that he left behind. Now, many people remember from their history books that Cecil Rhodes, oh, who was this guy? Oh, he was some Englishman, wasn't he? Oh, he was kind of wealthy, wasn't he? Well, yes, he was some Englishman, all right. He was one of the wealthiest men in the world at that time. He was the Chancellor of South Africa. He was the chief political dog there. He had acquired personal control over most of South Africa's diamond fields and gold mines. He was a tremendous natural resource that he now controlled, and so he amassed a vast fortune from that political advantage which he held there. All right, so good. Well, a lot of people get rich. So what? Well, the truth is that this man, when he died, did not leave that money to his heirs. He left almost the entirety of this vast fortune, and this was explained in a series of wills, which now are public. You can read them today. He left that vast fortune to the creation of a secret society, and the goal of that society was to gain control of the entire world and control it from the behind the scenes by the members of this secret society, who were not supposed to be well known. They were not supposed to be in the public eye. They would let the politicians do that. They would select the politicians, they said. They would control the politicians from behind the scenes using the leverage that they had primarily through the banking community and through their control of media. They would determine who would be the politicians that people would vote for and look to and cheer or throw tomatoes at or whatever it is. But the real power behind the scenes, they said, will be us. And we will be invisible to most of the world. And then they set about to create an organization to do exactly that. And the goal of this organization in the beginning was to promote the British Empire and the culture and the political concepts of the British Empire. They wanted that to be the center of the New World. They felt that the British had they were the best race, they said. They had the highest culture, the highest level of education. They were the high water mark of civilization, they said. And so therefore they felt that they had an obligation to the rest of the world to rule the world for their own good, you understand. It was an obligation, they felt.
It was sort of like a noblesse oblige.
Exactly, that's what it was.
Those were almost the very terms that they used. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. And they felt it was their obligation, and too bad somebody had to do it, but it might as well be them, since they were so well-educated and so blessed with this wonderful inheritance of this culture and so forth. That's how it started out. Now, it didn't take long after that, though, when the focus changed. Shortly after the death of Cecil Rhodes, the control of this structure became quite international in scope. It always was, but the center of gravity shifted from London to New York. And it became clear that J.P. Morgan and eventually the Rockefeller dynasty became the dominant forces within this group. And at that point, the goal was no longer to bring the world under the dominion of the British Empire, but to bring it under the dominion of an international organization, a new world order, they began to call it, which would be a centralized one-world government, and it was to be housed in New York City in the appearance of the United Nations, but it too would be controlled from behind the scenes by these very same people. But instead of promoting the British Empire, now they would promote globalism, a new world order based on the model of collectivism. It wasn't a very big shift in goal, except for the geography. The goal really remained pretty much the same, but the geography shifted from London to New York, and the control shifted away from the small group that was around Rhodes himself. It shifted eventually to J.P. Morgan and Company, and then eventually to the Rockefeller Group. And that's basically what it is today. And Quigley talked at great length in his books about how they created the secret society and modeled it almost exactly after some of the structures that were used in the classic conspiracies of the time. Anybody who has studied the structure of the Illuminati, for example, would recognize that this is the structure that Cecil Rhodes selected. Now, the Illuminati, as we know, was formed in 1776. It lasted for a relatively short period of time, and we are told, at least, that it was disbanded when it was raided by the Bavarian government and its secret papers were discovered, and they found out what they were trying to do, and so they disbanded the organization. Now, there's some controversy as to whether the organization didn't just go underground or whether it has sprung up again. None of that is important for this discussion. The important thing is that Adam Weishaupt, who was the founder of the Illuminati, spelled out in great detail how the structure of this secret society should operate, and it's what they call rings within rings within rings. That means that in the center of the organization there would be the founder, you know, the leader. He would be accompanied by two or three very closely trusted associates. That would be at the very center. Then they would create around the center a ring of members. They would create another organization with another name. They would bring in perhaps a dozen or 20 people, and they would let those people think that they were everything. They would not know that there was an inner direction from maybe three people. And these people in the outer ring would be convinced that their organization was at the center. Then they, in turn, would create another ring of membership around it of maybe several hundred or a thousand people, and those people would think they were the total organization without realizing that they, too, were being directed from an inner ring. And in this fashion, going from the center to the outer rings, each ring becoming larger and larger, it would be possible, they said, to control the masses of the world. And those people all on the outside of those organizations would never be aware of the inner direction. Well, that's what Adam Weishaupt created, and you can read about it in his papers. And interestingly enough, when Cecil Rhodes designed the structure for his organization, according to Quigley, he chose exactly that structure, rings within rings within rings. And you could go on and on with this, so let me cut right to the chase. The structure that he created had an inner core, and then it had one ring around it, and that ring was to be called the round tables. Those were, that was the round table, I should say. And then they created outer rings around them in each of the countries in which they operated. In that time, those were the former British dependencies. And so Canada had one, Britain had one, Australia had one, and so forth. But when it came to the United States, they didn't want to call it a round table, at least not in the open. And I should say, I'm back up a little bit. Around the round table, I missed this point. On the outside of the round table, there was another group or a front group, which in all of these British countries they called the Royal Institute of International Affairs. So that was the third ring out. And when it came to creating a Royal Institute of International Affairs in the United States, they decided that wouldn't sound too good because Americans didn't like the word royal. All the other countries had no problem with the Queen, you know, still being revered and so forth. But in America, nope, the Royal Institute of International Affairs wouldn't work, and so they changed the name to the Council on Foreign Relations. But it bears exactly the same relationship to the inner rings or the round tables and then to the inner rings of the Cecil Rhodes Secret Society as all the rest of them. So he goes into great detail to explain how the Council on Foreign Relations was created. Now, the significance of that is that the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States is the hidden government of the United States. It only has about 4,000 people in it, which is not big for an organization like that. And yet, when you look at the heads of all of the power centers of society, the key political figures in government, all the people in the political appointments, the head of the CIA, the State Department, head of the State Department, head of the Treasury Department, the President, the Vice President, senators, congressmen, all the way up and down the line. You look at the heads of the networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, Turner Broadcasting, Murdoch, the group. And take a look at all of the universities, the heads of the great universities, the people on the boards of directors. And you go all up and down the line and you find that about 80% of the great power centers of society are in the hands of members of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, don't forget about, of course, the great tax-exempt foundations. Forget about the other major banking industries, yes. The major corporations. And
yes.
People say, how could that anything be that vast? I mean, after all, if it were true, why Rush Limbaugh would tell us. Well, of course, that's what the Rush Limbaugh is for. His purpose is not to reveal, but to conceal. But you can find out for yourself. You simply write to, the Council on Foreign Relations, 58 East 68th Street in New York City. Ask for their annual report, and you'll get the list of all the members, and you'll find there Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, and, of course, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, go right ahead and pick the story up from there, Ed.
Well, we've come almost full circle to at least, this was a rapid run at this huge story, as you can imagine, because I wanted to get down to Quigley himself. Quigley approved of all of this. He said, this is pretty good, and he presented a very interesting challenge. He basically said, look, if we're going to run the world, we have to let the people in many countries, like the United States, Great Britain, and so forth, let them think that they are running their own nation. Because they've been taught that the right to self-government is very important, and they like to go to elections. They like to go to the polls, and they like to vote for their leaders. They love to vote. He said, well, they like to think that they're controlling their own political destiny through the vote. He said, well, how do we do that? How do we allow them to vote, and yet we still rule everything firmly from behind the scenes? And his answer was quite simple. He said, all you have to do is give them a choice between two political parties, and we control both of them. Let them fight between each other, going from our party A to our party B, and they can fight over secondary things. They can really get rough with each other. They can go to conventions. They can spend huge amounts of money. They can wave the flag, and they can attack each other, and everybody will think they've had a good fight. But it'll basically be like a professional wrestling match, one of those shows where the guy with the black mask gets up there and he tears into the guy with the blue tights, and they throw each other around. But the truth of the matter is they're both buddies, and it's all been determined ahead of time which one is going to win this Friday. And it's exactly the same thing, and the fans cheer for one and they cheer for the other. They have their favorites. And the idea was for the American people to feel that when they got disgusted with what was happening, that they could blame it on the political party, the guys that are in power now, and then all they have to do is just throw those rascals out and go to the other political party, and everything will be fine. Meanwhile, when it comes to the major political principles, the major issues, the leaders of both parties will be in total agreement.
In fact, in pages 1247 and 1248 of Professor Quigley's classic book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, he uses that very phrase. They go to the polls and throw the rascals out, but nothing will change. The foreign and domestic policy will remain the same. That's exactly what Professor Quigley says on page 1248. Let them throw the rascals out, but it's not going to make any difference.
Yeah. In fact, let me just read that phrase here. I've got it in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this is so important. Here's what Quigley says. He says the national parties and their presidential candidates, with the Eastern establishment assiduously fostering the process behind the scenes, moved closer together and nearly met in the center with almost identical candidates and platforms. Although the process was concealed as much as possible by the revival of obsolescent or meaningless war cries and slogans, often going back to the Civil War. The argument that the two parties should represent opposed ideals and policies, one perhaps of the right and the other of the left, is a foolish idea, acceptable only to the doctrinaire and academic thinkers. Instead, the two parties should be almost identical, so that the American people can throw the rascals out at any election without leading to any profound or extreme shifts in policy. Either party in office becomes in time corrupt, tired, unenterprising, and vigorless. Then it should be possible to replace it every 4 years if
hold
necessary.
Hold that thought for just
okay.
A moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ed was just quoting from the book written by Professor Quigley, called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, where Professor Quigley basically talks about the electoral process and how, of course, you can give the people the idea that they're having some input. You'll have two political parties, they'll both be pretty much the same. But every 4 years, the people can go to the polls, and in Professor Quigley's term, throw the rascals out. But it's not going to make any difference, because the policies of both political parties is essentially the same. And, of course, we saw that in the last elections, where, so many people, good people, voted for the Democrats. Maybe they'd never voted for the Democrats before, but they wanted to end the war in Iraq. They knew it was something was wrong there. We were losing people. We were killing Iraqis. We shouldn't have been there. So they voted for the Democrats, and nothing happened. Nothing changed. In fact, this is the way that it really is. You have to understand that both political parties are going the same direction, but we can't let the American people think that. Oh, and of course, congressmen, you know, no matter how strongly they may hold to their ideas once they get back to Washington, D.C. and find out how the system really works, realize that there'll be one-term congressmen if they try to buck the system. Better to go along, do what your party boss tells you, and maybe you'll get reelected. And maybe you can even be there at 4 or 5 or 6 terms. You get a nice pension and health benefits for the rest of your life. And so this is tragically the way it is. And we have two political parties. They pretend to fight over all these issues. Oh, my goodness, pro-life, homosexuality, family values, cutting the budget, cutting back on big government. But the truth of the matter is there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. Go ahead, Dad.
Well, that's certainly true. And even though the candidates will often come up with different positions during their campaigns, quite often after they're elected, they don't stick to their campaign promises anyway. They just determine what it is the people want to hear, and whatever it is that they think they can earn votes with, that's what they'll say. But after they're elected, they just don't follow through. So, and all of this seems quite implausible to the average person. It can't be so, they say, until they understand the Council on Foreign Relations, until they recognize that these people either are members themselves or are beholden to members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They have to learn what that organization is, its origin, how it was formed by a secret society, how it's still dominated by that secret society today. And this is not conspiracy theorists talking. This is all coming from Professor Quigley, who was the historian of this group and the mentor of President Bill Clinton. This is an authority that cannot be denied, and yet not many people are aware of it.
In fact, if you read the contemporary historians, they'll often refer back to Professor Quigley and comment, you know, that he was really one of the leading historians of the last century. And most people really are totally unaware of him, because the last thing the media wants is for you to understand the significance of what Professor Quigley wrote. In fact, his book was actively suppressed. We have an interview with Professor Quigley where he, it wasn't an interview I did, it was an interview he did with, I think, a reporter from the Washington Post. But there he tells about how his book was actively suppressed, how somebody came in and bought up Macmillan Publishers, who published the book originally back in 1966, and destroyed the plates of the first half of the book so that it could not be reprinted, and then lied to him and his wife for many years, saying they were going to reprint it when they had no intention of reprinting that book. The last thing they wanted was the American people to learn about the secret society that is the invisible government of the United States. And that interview, incidentally, is available through my ministry, and we've put out thousands of copies of that. I bought the rights to it for $100 many years ago from Professor Quigley's widow, and right to use it, and it was probably the best investment I ever made. Go right ahead, Ed.
Well, I didn't know you had done that, Stan. That's amazing. So, anyway, keep that up, because it's a hard book to read. It's a lot of dull history, but every once in a while, you'll come across a paragraph that will just knock you off your chair. You say, did he really say that? And yes, he really did. It's all laid out there. And once you just have to look at the political history of America since World War II, and you can see that. You don't have to go back all the way to World War II, but just let me see, where could we start with? How about the Carter administration? Remember, the electorate was overwhelmingly opposed to giving away the Panama Canal. Nobody wanted to do that. Republicans or Democrats at large didn't want to do that. And yet that was the goal of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so it happened. Then you can say, well, what about modern times? Republicans call for war in the Middle East, and they advocate that we give more power to the UN. Democrats call for peace in the Middle East and advocate that we give more power to the UN. Now, the electorate doesn't want that, but that is the goal of the Council on Foreign Relations. Republicans promote legislation to restrict rights in the name of anti-terrorism. Democrats give speeches of concern and then vote for those laws.
Hold that. We'll be back in just a moment with Ed Griffin right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ed is simply pointing out that the political parties say one thing, and then they do exactly the opposite. In other words, they say what the American people want to hear, and then once they're in positions of power, they pursue the standard agenda of the Council on Foreign Relations, whose leaders control the leadership of both political parties. So go right ahead, Ed.
Well, yes, you can go on down the line. I was reciting some things that came to mind where there appears to be a difference between the Republican position and the Democrat position, but there really isn't when you look at it. Perhaps the greatest example today would be that Republicans give speeches on the danger of illegal immigration. They don't do anything about it, but they give good speeches. The Democrats, they give speeches about compassion. And yet both parties at the top unite in merging the United States with Mexico and Canada so that immigration will no longer even be a meaningful issue. Now, the electorate doesn't want that, but it is progressing rapidly because that is the goal of the Council on Foreign Relations. Republican leaders steal elections with rigged e-voting machines, which are being built by primarily Republican management with these companies. And Democrat leaders accept their fate with no outcry. They're defeated by phony elections, and yet they just give a little whimper and say, I wonder if the elections were stolen, when it's clear that these machines not only can be rigged, but they were designed to be rigged. And that's because this is a high-tech implementation of the Quigley formula, giving the electorate the sensation, the feeling, the false concept that they are participating in their own political destiny. But yet both parties, like phony wrestlers on TV, they're just taking their turns to be winners, and the machines themselves will be programmed, and you will be told how you voted. It won't make any difference what you actually did vote. The machines will tell you how you voted. And unless you understand this picture and who's running the show, and unless you understand the Quigley formula, this will not make sense to you. You can't imagine how Republicans would let the Democrats get away with that, or how the Democrats would let the Republicans get away with that. Folks, it's because they're both on the same team.
And it's really fascinating to see this whole incredible story unfold. Why didn't John Kerry challenge the election in 2004? It was obviously there was voter fraud in Ohio. John Kerry had the money to do it, but you see, they both came from both he and George Bush came from the same secret society, the Count of the Skull and Bones. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Ed is simply pointing out the fraudulent nature of the transition of power in the United States. In Kenya recently, when there was obviously voter fraud, why, of course, you saw the people out in the streets and demonstrating, and the number of people have been killed over there, and suddenly the structure of the society has begun to crumble simply because the people know there was voter fraud. But people say, isn't it wonderful in America? We don't have that sort of thing. We get the peaceful transition from administration to administration, and people don't understand it's all a fraud. I mean, they actually rig the elections. They give us a choice of two of their candidates, and whichever one that they want elected usually gets elected. If the candidate they want elected doesn't get elected, then they send him on a trip to Dallas, as they did with John Kennedy, and at least three members of the Warren Commission came for the Council on Foreign Relations. The other three were Masons, and at least there were three Masons and three members of the Council, or maybe four members of the Council on Foreign Relations on the Warren Commission to see whether or not there'd been a conspiracy behind the murder of an American president. Well, anyway, before we go on, Ed, I want you to get your web page out there and tell people how they can get in touch with what you're doing now, because I know that you are working very hard with people not only in the United States but throughout the world to try to reestablish a representative form of government under our system so that we can at least try to preserve our form of society for generations unborn. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stan. We have two websites. The first one is our commercial website. That's our money-grubbing website where we sell things. We have a lot of books and recordings, and they deal with the issues that we're talking about, plus a lot more. So if you want to see the documentation for what I'm talking about or what Stan is talking about, you'll find it at the Reality Zone. So that's www.realityzone.com. And we have, at the present time, about 100 different items there, and most of them, I think you're going to say, are really dynamite.
Now, what about American media and the videos and tapes and other things that you have available? Put in a plug for them. Don't be bashful.
That is the American media site. We decided that calling it the American media site was kind of not exciting. It didn't have any movement to it, so we renamed it some years ago, Stan. We called it the Reality Zone.
Okay, fine.
But it's the marketing arm of American media. And at Reality Zone, we have a lot of other things other than those just made by American media. So it's an appropriate name for it. But where we really get into the ideology and the principles and the real thinking that needs to be done behind these issues, we have another website, and that's called Freedom Force. Actually, the full name is Freedom Force International. And that's named after an organization which we now have. It's operating in 57 countries now. We have members in 57 countries. People in every country in the world are facing similar problems, and we're trying to bring these people together in truly an international brotherhood where everybody is on the same page regarding the principles of freedom. We know what we're for as well as what we're against, and we're trying to mobilize an international movement to turn this tide. And anybody that's interested in really doing something about this, rather than just learning about it or wringing your hands about it and saying, my, isn't this terrible? What are we going to do? There is a solution, and you'll find it at the Freedom Force website. So the URL, or whatever they call that thing, the email address for that is, or the website address, is www.freedomforceinternational.org. Org stands for organization. FreedomForceInternational.org.
And I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that Ed is a very dedicated individual, and the work he does is tremendous. As I say, we've known Ed for 45 years. He's certainly one of the major leaders of the effort to try to preserve our country. Okay, fine. Well, let's go on now. Of course, we've been talking about Professor Carroll Quigley, one of the most significant individuals, not because he would agree with us, on what the way of life should be, because he was an elitist. He was an aristocrat. He looked down upon people like you and I. He refers to us repeatedly in his book as the petty bourgeois who voted for Barry Goldwater. He looked with disdain upon anybody who, of course, believed in the communist conspiracy, because he realized, of course, that the communist conspiracy, it was all a myth, that it had been created by these elitists to take away the attention from what they were doing, so that when we saw Eastern Europe go communist after the Second World War and China go communist after the Second World War, and why, of course, people would think it was the communists working in government that had done that, whereas it was really, as according to Professor Quigley, it was these people who really controlled American foreign policy, working at our State Department and the highest levels of government, who brought about, the communist control of Eastern Europe and communist control of China, because you needed an enemy to distract people's attention away from what was going on at home. And so, as long as we had a foreign enemy, we would rally the people loyally and patriotically behind our government, as, of course, the people who really controlled our government could move us from being a republic to a democracy to an autocracy, and into this situation where they could use the military and financial power of the United States to bring about the real goal, and that would be the one world government. And only later have I come to realize, of course, the influence of religion in this, because they want a one world religion. And then, of course, down the line, they would like to have a one-world leader. That's what Plato advocated, and so much of what is going on today really has its origins in the writings of Plato almost 2,500 years ago. So you pick up the story there, Ed.
Well, I'm almost in intellectual fatigue as we race through this story, Stan.
You've told it so many times, though, and you can tell it better than anyone I know.
While you were recounting that history, very fascinating history, and I certainly agree, I was wondering what the average person would feel who happened to tune in for the first time, has never heard any of this before, they probably think that you and I are complete raving lunatics.
Well, of course, fortunately, we do have Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, although it's suppressed for many years. It is available. We do have his second book, The Anglo-American Establishment. We even have an interview with Professor Quigley, and we carry another book that Professor Quigley talked about called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, because it goes into how the Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie Foundations are pushing communism and socialism and trying to destroy the love which every American should have for his way of life. And at least these books are available. And if people were to read them and to listen to the interviews that with Professor Quigley and Norman Dodd, and incidentally, Ed has a wonderful video of an interview he did with Norman Dodd, going into the background of really how so much of this fits together. If they would just simply check out the facts, there's no question at all that everything we have been told growing up isn't true. We are not a democracy, no matter what our leaders say. We are a republic, and there's all the difference in the world between a republic and a democracy. And if we could just get people to, just for 1 minute, just stop and question, is it possible that everything I was ever taught in school and everything I'm being told by the media and everything I'm being told my leaders is really a lie, and that there is another agenda behind everything? And as you look at what's going on, there's so many contradictions, so many things just don't make sense. I mean, here we have our troops over there in Afghanistan. We control Afghanistan. We have a war on drugs. We spend millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in the war on drugs, and yet when America occupies Afghanistan, the center of the heroin opium production, why they have the biggest crops we've ever had. How can that be? How can you fight a war on drugs and yet you control the country that's making all those drugs? How do you explain things like that? Paradoxes? I mean, how can it be that America could have fought almost a 10-year war in Vietnam and lost the war? Or simply, why can't we win the war over in Iraq? And there's so many questions out there. I hope, Ed, if people did drop in accidentally and hear us, maybe they'll at least momentarily wonder, is it possible that we've not been told the truth?
Well, that's the thought that crossed my mind a moment ago. I think the magic word in your discourse just then was that if people will do this, if people will read that, if people will stop and think, the magic word is if. I think, unfortunately, many people will not. They'll listen to the magnitude of the problem as you and I are describing it, and they'll say, ah, this is impossible, and they will not be so inclined to check it out. But that's what I fear. And, of course, I see that happening quite often with people I know. When I tell them some of these things, they kind of roll their eyes and say, well, that's absurd. I'm not even gonna listen any further to this, you know. And you can almost understand it. And I think one of the problems is that certainly it's the problem with me. In the earlier days, especially when I became first aware of some of these things, I would go around trying to inform everybody about everything all at once. And instead of just giving them a little piece of information, I'd back up the truck, pull the lever, and dump the whole load on them, you know. And I'd never hear from them again.
We've all had that experience.
It
takes many, many months of reading and studying and thinking and contemplating and challenging and wondering before you suddenly begin to realize that everything you've learned and been taught is a lie. And I remember one time this woman telling me, she said, I listened to you for about 6 months, and I thought you were crazy, until I finally realized that what you were saying was true. And so now I'm trying to tell other people, and they think I'm crazy.
Well, that's the way it goes. At least you got one more crazy person on the team.
Now we've got one more sane person on the scene. Tragically, is most of the people out there in the listening audience really, well, of course, those who listen to our programs regularly have a grasp of what's going on, but so many people who do not have no idea, because this could not be true. And yet, if you stop and look at what's going on, there's no way you can understand so much of what's taking place today. For instance, our hard line against communism for so many years, all the while we were funding and financing communism, and our hard line against Fidel Castro, and yet And of course, and he had, of course, David Rockefeller's daughter as a close personal friend of Fidel's, and that's covered, of course, in David Rockefeller's book, Memoirs. And even Fidel comes up to visit with David Rockefeller, and why can't the CIA, who hates Fidel and wants to kill him and have him assassinated, why can't they have him assassinated while he's here in the United States if they really wanted to do it? But they don't want to do that. Fidel is the finest enemy that money could buy. We've been financing him by financing communist countries and other countries that have been financing Fidel for years, and we never get paid back, but they give him the money. We send the people into the Bay of Pigs, not to win, but to lose intentionally. We promise them air cover. We promise them, reinforcements, and oh, shucks, oh, we're just such bungling idiots. Oh, there's just nothing we can do about it. And those men got slaughtered and left there to die. They were men who trusted the United States and trusted that we would, of course, keep our promise to them. But all shucks, nobody's responsible for all of the terrible mistakes that take place. And I don't believe that for 1 minute, do you?
No, not at all. Of course, they're not mistakes. If you understand the true strategy and the true goals, they're not mistakes at all. They're brilliantly executed maneuvers. But anyway, in thinking in terms of how to communicate this horrendous story to the person that just sort of comes along off the street for the first time, I found that maybe it's wise to stick to one aspect of the problem at a time and sort of drill down into that. And we started out tonight talking about the alleged two-party system and the fact that both parties are effectively under the control of members of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a well-identified group. It's not secret. You can't go to their meetings unless you're invited, and the news people that go there are pledged not to report. But other than that, it's not a secret organization. They have a publication. Many of the speeches that are given at their meetings are published. You can buy the publication and the newsstand and so forth. So it's not a secret organization per se. But once you understand what it is and that the goal that they have set for themselves is world government based on the model of collectivism, and that means the elimination of the United States as a sovereign nation, and then you see who these people are and the important positions they hold, and then you say, oh my gosh, that is why we're losing our sovereignty. That is why our money is being debauched, and we're going to replace it with a regional currency, three-nation currency, and eventually a world currency. And all of a sudden, you begin to realize that everything makes sense, where previously it didn't make sense at all.
And I think on that issue, I mean, why is the Bush administration steadfastly refused to, guard our borders? Now, of course, every once in a while, they'll put on a little drive there, or they may add a few more, border guards, but they're still not doing an effective means. They've steadfastly refused to build a fence. They've steadfastly refused to go after all of the employers who are hiring the illegal immigrants and acting as a magnet to bring them in. And, they may, after once in a while, they'll put on a show of raiding this plant or that plant, but they never go after the big boys like Tyson and the others who hire the illegal immigrants and drive the prices down. It's all showbiz.
And of course, why should they defend the borders when their ultimate goal is to eliminate the borders?
Absolutely. And if you can just get people to think for a minute, they'll begin to see, is it possible that Ed Griffin is right, that we're really not trying to stop illegal immigration because our leaders want to merge us with Mexico?
It's not only possible, it's a fact of life, and you can see it growing every day.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Well, the number of people who used to look at me and say, I don't believe that, that would never happen, that has dropped off now to almost zero.
Well, I think that things are getting so bad that it is very obvious to people that something is seriously wrong. And, Ed, as we see the implosion of our financial system, the collapse of the fiat money system, literally millions of people lose their homes and their cars and their jobs and their life savings, I think that we're going to come to a point where we're going to have a very definite opportunity to teach people what's going on. The question is, will we be able to get and reach enough people in time to prevent the destruction of our nation, or will, of course, our enemies, the enemies of freedom, use this as an opportunity to establish their dictatorship? And we know that they're already planning, for mass disturbances, because, of course, they've given Halliburton $385 million to stand by over a 5 or 4 year period to build detention camps. Now, why would they do something like that? And anybody can go up on the internet and Google in detention camps, $385 million, Halliburton, and it's there. Find out what's going on. Challenges. Try to prove he's wrong. And if you can't, then I hope you'll join Ed and I and the other band of patriots who've pretty given their lives in trying to save this country. Ed, let's get your website out one more time.
Well, yes. The place where we have our books, audios, and videos is realityzone.com. And the place where you'll find all of the historical information and the ideological information on freedom and the movement is freedomforceinternational.org.
That's at realityzone.com and freedomforceinternational.org. Realityzone.com, international.org. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Ed, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, and then I'm going to let you go.
Well, 3 minutes. How do we wrap it up?
Well, we've covered a lot of information. And
yeah, let's focus on the main thing, I think, that I don't believe that we're going to be able to recover our freedoms unless we can get the American people to see through this smoke and mirrors, this magical show that they call the two-party system. And as long as they honestly believe that they have a choice, a meaningful choice, by jumping from Republican to Democrat, then there is no hope, because they will never realize that both camps are being run by basically the same group, which is the Council on Foreign Relations, and therefore both camps will have the same ultimate long-range goals, and those goals involve the dismemberment, the elimination of the United States of America as a sovereign nation, and merging it, first of all, into a regional government with Mexico and Canada, and then ultimately into a true world government based on the model of collectivism. They have to realize that the two-party system is a scam. Unless they do that, there is no hope. But it should be easy enough to realize that once you get the idea in your head and just start looking at these candidates and what they stand for and what they do, and listening to their cheerleaders, I mean, when I say cheerleaders, I'm talking people like Rush Limbaugh, who thinks Republicans are fine, but he doesn't like Democrats. And you got another cheerleader like Michael Moore. He thinks the Democrats are fine, but Republicans are bad. All of these people that sort of lead public opinion, they're all aligned, either Republican or Democrat. They try to limit the national debate to that issue. You get a man like Ron Paul coming along, even though he's running on the Republican ticket, he does not fit the mold. He doesn't pay allegiance to either party, and so they hate him with a passion. Once you understand this, then everything fits in. And once you understand that, I think we'll have a revolution in American politics, where candidates will be running as independents, or at least candidates in both political parties will be running on policies that are not dominated by the Council on Foreign Relations. That's the day that we'll begin to reverse this tide.
And, of course, it's not going to happen unless the good people of America are involved. And the thing is that most people in America are good people, but, you know, most of them would like to just be left alone and live their lives out and be free. And the trouble is, freedom is not free. And if we're not involved, believe me, the other side is. The other people on the other side have given their whole of their lives to transforming the world. Can we, of course, do any less if we hope to pass on this wonderful freedom to generations unborn? We're out of time. Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ed Griffin, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on board with us.
Well, thank you, Stan. It has indeed been a pleasure for me also.
Bye-bye and God bless.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, that was Ed Griffin, and certainly one of my favorite people and one of the great leaders of the conservative movement, who's given his whole life in this effort to try to rekindle that spark of freedom that once burned so brightly in the hearts of the American people. And everything has been done, to, of course, to take us away from that, to get us involved in sensuality and immorality and change the mores of our country. And, of course, behind everything that's going on are powerful spiritual forces that, of course, are energizing the wicked people on the other side. And many of them are wicked people. Some of them are simply idealists. They really don't understand what it's all about, and they're so readily manipulated. But I think Ed's point is so valid. You must understand that the battle between right and left, conservative and liberal, Republican and Democrat, is all of a sort to conceal what's really going on behind the scenes, and that is that the Council on Foreign Relations, which is located at 58 East 68th Street in New York City, is America's invisible government. And if you want to verify that, you simply write to them and ask for their annual report. They'll send it to you. That's 58 East 68th Street in New York City, New York. Get the information from them, and then, of course, go to our website and get up on the Internet. Go to Ed Griffin's website and then join us in this truly epic struggle for the survival of the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Well, we, of course, do hope that many of you will certainly go to my website, RadioLiberty.com. You certainly should get Professor Quigley's wonderful book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, or the special, which includes the interview with Professor Quigley and the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, or simply get his second book, The Anglo-American Establishment. They're such important sources of information. I keep a copy of Tragedy and Hope right next to me where I can refer to it at any time. There's so much vital information there, especially the fact that this whole myth of communism, certainly we lost an awful lot of boys fighting communism, but we never tried to win the war in Vietnam. We lost a lot of boys fighting communism in Korea. We never tried to win the war any more than we're really trying to win the war in Iraq and Afghanistan today. And that's why I want to bring the boys home. Now, if you question what I say, you go up to RadioLiberty.com and you pull my December 2007 letter down. It is simply a speech that was given by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who commanded the American forces and the coalition forces between June 2003 and June 2004, and he will tell you the military has not been allowed to win the battle. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that they're betraying our boys. And if you go along with that, saying patriotism is supporting the boys, you're, of course, part of the problem. General Casey recently testified before Congress saying our military is being destroyed. It'll take, years to get it back into an adequate position. We're destroying our equipment. We're destroying our men. Our officers, our enlisted men, are leaving the military. And do you blame them? If you care about America, read my December 2007 newsletter, the speech by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. And then you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to, listen to my talk on the Forbidden Secret. Let me point out, ladies and gentlemen, that the price of wheat hit $20 a bushel today. Soybeans were at a new all-time high. Corn is a new all-time high. Food is becoming increasingly difficult to get, not only here, but throughout the world. Oh, you've got it on yourselves, but start thinking about laying in a supply of emergency food, because, of course, I believe we're going to be moving towards world famine. And if you'd like to get a copy of our catalog on emergency food, call us at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and we'll be back here in just a moment for the next hour of Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests. And, well, of course, our guest today is James Sandquist for this next hour. And James has written a couple of books, Who is Driving the Purpose-Driven Church, and what's the title of the second one, James?
Rick Warren's Global Peace Plan versus Scripture.
Global Peace Plan versus Scripture. And for those of you who listened to our last hour, you remember we were talking about the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, Rick Warren, who is probably, well, he's been named by Time Magazine as America's leading minister, now having replaced Billy Graham. Rick Warren is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he is totally transforming the structure of the churches throughout America today. They've changed the music of the church and gotten away from the old hymns onto truly rock music that has a profound impact on your psyche, and, of course, many times will put you into almost a trance-like state, fascinated by the beat and by the rhythm. And of course, this has nothing to do with Christianity. You're simply being opened up to metaphysical possession, in my estimation. The message of the church is not one of salvation, the need for a Savior, that we're all sinners saved by grace. But we are going, of course, to use the church to transform the world and to make everybody happy. And, of course, everything is about happiness. But, of course, the traditional Christian teaching is simply becoming very rapidly a remembrance of things past. Well, James has certainly been on the front lines of trying to get the information out, and this evening he was going to be talking about what's happening to some of the churches who don't like what's going on. And believe me, all across America, there are people at least who can still think and know something seriously wrong, and they're trying to get out of their denomination that's gone for the purpose-driven church. The whole approach there. And so you pick up the story, James. What is really happening, and how are they preventing many congregations from leaving the fold?
Well, Dr. Stan, it's a pleasure being with you again. It's been a number of times, and I've always wondered how you were so able to be so relentless, never running out of energy, and then it occurred to me with your introduction that you're sitting out over Monterey Bay. Well, that'll give anybody a transfusion to have more mileage in their battery.
Well, we're very, very blessed to live where we do.
In any case, to answer your question, the most recent development as to what is anything being done to stop this tsunami of purpose-driven church and the church growth movement in the church. Most recently, of course, has been, as I sent you an email, a press release, is what happened in the Christian and Missionary Alliance Church, where the wheat said to the tares, basically, enough already, and the decided that when they Christian the Chinese church in Colorado Springs, who actually had tried to go along with the purpose-driven agenda, the formulas for a healthy church and church growth, and tried to comply with these small group agendas and this propaganda that was going into the church, and many of them in this church out there didn't even know and never heard of Rick Warren, for that matter. But what has happened, Dr. Stan, is that in some cases the purpose-driven is kind of like my wife describes it well, that the Band-Aid is a brand in a store.
Hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment with James Sandquist. James, go right ahead.
Yes. In any case, the my wife describes it well, that there's Band-Aid brand in a store, but there's many types of generic Band-Aids. You'd appreciate this being a doctor, Dr. Stan, that you have many types of things that have that little pad with the stick-em on it. You stick them on for a wound that aren't officially Band-Aid company, but they still function the same, do all the principles of a Band-Aid. Well, the same with the purpose-driven and movement, that a lot of times they will copy all of the principles and all of these formulas and quotas and bringing them into the church, and they'll bring in these covenants that they have to sign. They require the tithing, and they monitor your giving and patrol your giving. You know, Big Brother's really here, but would you have ever expected it would be the church that would be Big Brother, Dr. Stan? So anyway, this Chinese church tried to go along with this, but couldn't conform to the demands of the Christian Missionary Alliance Church. So the Christian Missionary Alliance Church closed down this Chinese church. It was called the Chinese Alliance Church in Colorado Springs. And then after that, they seized their $650,000 property, and which will consummate the sale at the end of on the 29th of February this month. They sold it to a karate parlor, and they cleaned them out, emptied out their $18,000 bank account, and they even took all of their Chinese translation Bibles, which and the heirloom collection in their library, trashed a lot of their stuff in there. And one of the people witnessed them just throwing all of the stuff in their church right into the trash can.
Well, who is doing this, and how can they do that?
They claim they can do this. And it's becoming more well known. It's a term called reversion or reversionary clause.
And then who is actually taking it? It's the National Association of this alliance that you're speaking of?
The National Headquarters has approved this, and they oversee it. They oversee the number of districts. In other churches, they call them, like the Episcopal, they call it, district is the equivalent of a diocese.
In other words,
case, it was specifically the Mid-American District Headquarters Office, which is in Omaha, Nebraska, that oversees several states, including Colorado.
In other words, basically, if you are doing things they don't approve of, they come in and take over your church, even though that the parishioners have paid for it. Is that it?
Yes.
Hold on. I will be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and James is talking about this church. It's in Colorado. It's a Chinese church, part of a missionary alliance congregation, and because they wouldn't go along with the purpose-driven church, why, of course, the people, I'm sure, wanted to have their own type of religious practices. That, after all, they'd been donating, that had they purchased a church property and built the church themselves, or was the church perhaps possibly given to them by the central authority?
No, I've studied the documents extensively. I've seen the deeds, the transfer of the deeds, the titles. I've seen the email exchanges by both parties. The church borrowed approximately $80,000 from a fund called the Alliance Development Fund, and the Christian Missionary Alliance headquarters has a division for that in Colorado Springs. And interestingly enough, the church that was seized is also in Colorado Springs. They had purchased the property on a 15-year mortgage, and they borrowed money from the headquarters under a fund they call the Alliance Development Fund. But they got a 15-year mortgage, and they paid off the mortgage in 15 years. So they're actually a classic model of good stewardship.
Well, of course, did they pay back the $80,000 they borrowed from the Missionary Alliance?
Absolutely. In full. In half the years of the 15-year mortgage, 7 to 8 years, right in there approximately.
Well, but then how can the Missionary Alliance headquarters have a hold on their property and be able to take it away from them just because the local congregation doesn't agree with the purpose-driven church concepts, that this corporate structure that's being imposed upon the churches and the congregation from above?
They use a term called the reversionary clause that's in their national constitution, and A host of the members don't even know what the reversionary clause is, but most of, if not all of the pastors know what the reversionary clause is, which enables the church that if the church ever dissolves, decides they don't want to be Christian Missionary Alliance, they have to surrender all of the assets of their local church to the district they're in. In this case, the Mid-America District in Omaha, Nebraska, they have to surrender all of the property to them. But this Chinese church didn't want to surrender the property, and they were a fully functioning, with a approved by the state of Colorado, and they were approved to do business by, as a corporation in the state of Colorado before they were became affiliated with the Christian Missionary Alliance. And during the entire time, they fulfilled the obligations. They sent in all of their tithes and offerings, everything they were supposed to do. And the church was then decided that they wanted to sell this property so they could make this $650,000. And so they came in and made up a bunch of trumped up excuses of why the church wasn't meeting their church growth formulas and healthy, what they call healthy church criteria, and so they decided to close it down. And even though the church had paid off the loan, this Christian Missionary Alliance Church in it's called Chinese Alliance Church in Colorado Springs, they did not default on the loans. They were not even delinquent in their payments. And get this, even after they had paid off the church in full, they didn't owe anything. Randy Berg, who is the district director, comes in and tells them that the falling off of tithing and donations and offerings of the church that will cease. And it's rather amazing that they already cleaned them out of their church property. $18,000, all their Chinese translation Bibles. They didn't even have enough money to pay for gas to take these elderly Chinese people from communist China to come over to take them to the hospital. The headquarters of the Missionary Alliance Church, in collusion with the district, Mid-America District in Omaha, Nebraska, used this reversionary clause, which says they have to if they do not become Christian Missionary Alliance Church anymore, they've got to surrender the property. But
had they actually signed a contract to that fact? And couldn't they get a lawyer and fight this? After all, it was their property. They bought it. They paid for it. They were a community, and they didn't like what was being imposed from above. Wasn't there any means that they could get a lawyer to defend them against this?
Well,
seizure of their property?
In fact, they did. The news people inquired of me, how did this Chinese people have their property seized find out about me? And what they did is they did a search under the Christian Missionary Alliance and under the term reversionary clause in my article up on my website. Which, by the way, you can find my website in this article, this press release on this that I sent you, Dr. Stan. Just type in my name, James Sundquist, Sundquist, in Google search engine. In the very top website is our website, and the top three and four articles on the top of the website have to do with this Christian and Missionary Alliance virtual swindle of these Chinese people's church and these older people from China. A lot of them came from communist China. Can you imagine having your Bibles burned under Mao in China, and then coming to the United States? The Christian Missionary Alliance doesn't burn your Bibles, but they steal your Bibles and your church. They can't help but wonder if they aren't still in communist China, Dr. Stan.
Well, of course. What about getting legal, aid or some sort of means of doing this?
I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question on that. They after they looked up my article on the reversionary clause, which is on the website, They contacted me through the email that's there. That's not mine, but the website email. And then they contacted me, so I responded back and wanted to help them and counsel them. Well, it turns out that they had already made a decision that they were going to file a lawsuit against the Dr. Robert Trempert and Randy Berg. Robert Trempert was the interim pastor that was sent by Randy Berg, who's the district director, to be this interim pastor to come in and allegedly help them get their church comply with these church growth formulas and get them rolling so they could qualify with their quotas. But their real intent, as it was proved by all the documentation, was to actually seize the property. So when this became evident with the documentation, the group of the members of the Chinese church that filed a lawsuit that was consummated on February 8th of this year, and they served papers to the both the headquarters are listed in the lawsuit, as well as the Christian Missionary Alliance in Colorado Springs, as well as a pastor who is actually an executive pastor in another church in Colorado Springs, Dr. Robert Trempert, as well as the district office in Omaha, Nebraska, and who is named in that lawsuit along with this is Randy Berg, and he was served. The attorneys had arranged to have the police in Omaha, Nebraska, serve them papers there. So there's four principal parties that were served, but there's a number of other people involved in the conspiracy that are named in my 40-page report.
All right, fine, but of course, then have they actually sold this church out from underneath the congregation? Is the majority of the congregation feel that they do not want to be affiliated with the national organization? Certainly, the majority of the people in the church would make that decision, wouldn't they?
Well, it all depends on the denomination, as you know, Dr. Stan. If you're a Baptist or congregationally ruled, the majority of the members, it's totally decisions about what you do with the property are totally made by the local church. But in a hierarchical organization, such as the Roman Catholic Church, that the decisions are made at the top, not that some decisions aren't made locally, but the government who makes the final decisions.
But of course, this is not the Catholic Church. This is a Missionary Alliance Church,
right? And it's a combination of hierarchical and local governing church versus a hierarchical or ruled at the top. So it's a mixed bag with the Christian Missionary Alliance. That's why they have this in this reversion clause. And by the way, Dr. Stan, they're not the only one filing suit in to retain their property, their own church property. The Grace Episcopal Church in Colorado Springs just a month ago also filed a lawsuit because the Episcopal Church tried to exercise the reversionary clause that the property would revert back to the diocese, or in their what would be the equivalent of the district headquarters for the Episcopal Church. But the reason that that local church wants to retain their property and not surrender it to the district headquarters in that case is because the church is a doctrinal issue. They don't believe in gay marriages and things like this, so they're splitting off so that they can hold to scripture.
Well, of course, the thing is, of course, that this really is all a means of control. It's a means of control from the top. And we're gonna, if you don't want to go along with us, we take your property, we take your money, and of course, I've seen this thing happen through the years in other denominations, Presbyterian and such. It's really a means of controlling the people, and that's not what Christianity is really about. Well, you go ahead with the story there, then.
Okay, Dr. Stan, they were supposed to be given about 15 months to redevelop their church in Colorado Springs, and then this was, I'm going back a little in time, and so the church, but after 3 months' time, the district of the Mid-America Atlantic District reneged on their deal to give them the 15 months in order to comply with this redevelopment strategy. And this redevelopment strategy, that which harks back to all the principles in the purpose-driven church, which is also greatly touted and endorsed and promoted in the Christian Missionary Alliance all over this country as well as in Canada. In fact, I think I talked in my first book about how, if I was on the air with you before, about how a number of elderly people were driven out of a church up in Christian Missionary Alliance Church in Canada who were not complying with the purpose-driven principles.
That is one of the basic concepts of the purpose-driven church, is to get rid of the pillars. To get rid of the pillars of the church. In other words, the older people who are just holding things up. That's what pillars do. They hold things up. And so if you want to have progress, you get rid of the older people. Doesn't sound like a very Christian approach to me, but it's all about management. It's all about control. That's what the purpose-driven church, the purpose-driven movement is really all about. And until people understand that and how well that fits into this whole concept of the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Leader, then, of course, once you understand the common drive behind it, the fact that Rick Warren is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front group for a secret society dedicated to a one-world government, a one-world religion. You don't want to go along with the new things, the new changes? Why, of course, you're going to lose out, aren't you?
Yeah, you lose out big time. In fact, they, as I understand it, the Christian Missionary Alliance has, I was told by a witness out in California where they're telling me about they were closing churches down out there, too, the Christian Missionary Alliance. And in fact, in your area, San Jose, and was one example in Sacramento, I think, Oakland, right in there, that area, I'm not sure the specific town, and they were saying that the Christian Missionary Alliance has this agenda now to where it's, I don't know if it's 5% or some percentage of the churches that is a mandate to close down in order that number of churches in the Christian Missionary Alliance in order to create, to get the capital in order to plant churches, which is kind of ironic, and if not absurd, that they sell out the properties on these churches, close them down, sell the property, take the money to plant churches, but they already have a church. So why did they close the church down in order to get the money to plant a church when they already have a church?
Well, no, but why are they closing the church down? Because they don't go along with the agenda of the purpose-driven church?
In this case, that is correct, although they didn't call it purpose-driven in this particular lawsuit, but it nevertheless had the exact same church growth movement, church multiplication, church health formulas for measuring spirituality, small group strategies. They brought in this the small group printed materials for this Chinese church.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here with James. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's James Sundquist, who's written several books on this. The whole problem of the purpose-driven church and this whole idea of the church growth movement, which is really a management style. It's all a matter of control. It's a matter of changing the music, changing the message of the church, getting everybody to go along, and if you don't go along, you're asked to leave the church. It's just that simple. And especially if you're an older individual who believes that they ought to be preaching the gospel and preaching that we're all sinners saved by grace and that we need a Savior. But you see, that's old-fashioned. What we need is this dream of we are going to remake the world. The world is going to change because of what the Christians are going to do. But we're not preaching Christianity. We're preaching social change. Well, anyway, there's this one church in Colorado Springs didn't want to go along with the new agenda. They were a Chinese church. They tried, and it just didn't work. And of course, they sent in. Now, why did they send? Was there a minister there? Did they need a new minister? Why was the new minister sent in from the central authority into this Chinese church? Did they ask for a minister?
They didn't ask for this particular minister.
Did they ask for any minister? Did they need a minister?
Yes, they wanted one that spoke Chinese or at least understood the Chinese culture, and they had one. But the Christian Missionary Alliance shipped him off to Florida.
Well, did he want to go, or did they force him to go?
Well, it's one of these things. Give you an offer you can't refuse. From the Godfather, if you get my drift.
All right.
So they didn't have one that spoke Chinese, and then they brought in these small group things, which are also in the purpose-driven Christian and Missionary Alliance is using that, but the small group materials, they brought them into this church and wouldn't even translate them into English, because a number of the people were could only read Chinese, and they spoke Cantonese and Mandarin Chinese. So the few that spoke English could handle the English and read the English, but the rest couldn't read the Chinese. So they were forced to have to learn English in 3 months, or have their church closed down. Isn't that crazy? So, in any case, after 3 months, it was clear what the agenda was all along. It was not really to get the church to even comply with these formulas for church growth, but to close down. But the fact is that this thing would have never happened to implement this reversion clause for the headquarters to take the church property if it weren't for the church growth movement, the purpose-driven movement. That's really the thorn bush that has produced this plague of poison figs. And the reason that it didn't work in a lot of churches is because it's kind of when you eat food that's poisoned, you don't really know it right away, and then all of a sudden you wonder why you've become a human volcano. Because it's just being spewed out of your mouth. You can't absorb it. And these people were a praying church. They had regular Bible studies. They had a passionate outreach to the community there. They held this outreach in this Chinese restaurant, and they were getting people saved. And now I was told that the Chinese community, they said that this is how Christians are treated. They never want to become a Christian. Isn't that a great witness?
Right. Well, I think, of course, it's obviously a power structure, and who got the $650,000?
The headquarters for the mission for the Mid-America, Mid-Atlantic district.
Don't the people have any recourse through legal? You say they are filing a lawsuit against the central authority?
Yeah, they filed it on February 8th,
the property's already sold by this time. I mean, they've taken the $18,000 that they had, and they've destroyed all of their Chinese translated Bibles. Why would they wait such a long period of time to do what they should have done long before?
You mean, why didn't they file suit sooner?
Right.
Well, because this culture, and I was explained that they don't like conflict. They want to go along and do what they're told, and they don't want to make trouble. It's very, very unusual for the Chinese people to be filing a lawsuit. They were, of course, hammered with the scripture, 1 Corinthians 6, 5 through 8, about suing a brother. But, of course, if Jesus Christ would say that somebody would do this to somebody... depart from me, you wicked and cursed, I never knew you. So that it's arguable whether they're even Christians to have done this, so you wouldn't...
Hold that, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And so they have no leadership. Do they have a board of elders or a board of deacons in the church that is trying to get this thing straightened out? Who is actually bringing the lawsuit against the central authority?
Well, what happened next, Dr. Stan, was they knew a Baptist church, a Southern Baptist church in town, where they had gone there to get their new converts baptized. So they got a great relationship with Pastor David Fitzgerald there of Garden Ranch Baptist Church, who helped these refugees that were fleeing and thrown out on their ear on the street. They helped them get back on their feet and gave them a place to meet and helped them form their own separate nonprofit church corporation with the state of Colorado and fully complying with the regulations of the state, and help them get back on their feet. So this, my hat is off to this Garden Ranch Baptist Church, because they truly were the Good Samaritan, taking care of the thieves that left these people in the ditch, figuratively speaking. And so they helped them get their organizationally together, and then a group of people from this new Chinese church, former members of the CMA, Chinese Alliance Church, they formed a group of people that were the former members. Then they got themselves an attorney, and they filed this lawsuit to get back the property. And I'm not sure how it will totally work, but as you know from lawsuits, civil lawsuits, Dr. Stan, they have both punitive and compensatory damages. But these Chinese people are really not out for blood. They just want their church back. Well, they're not going to get their building back, because the karate people that came in have already remodeled it to conform to what they want to do with the karate parlor. And so what they would be getting back would be the proceeds from the sale of the property, and they'd have to go build their own church or buy one that's already made that fits their needs. But they certainly also could get back the $18,000 that the CMA stole from them out of their bank account. You'd think that
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and James is just telling us a very tragic story of the already, of course, having nothing to do with Christianity, how the hierarchy of this organization, Christian Missionary Alliance, took over this church and sold it out from underneath the people and pocketed the $650,000 that had actually, of course, been put forward by the members of the church as they bought the property and took their $18,000 out of the bank. And they really precipitated the whole problem by actually taking the minister out of the church and sending him to another area, and then putting a minister in. And did this other minister speak Chinese?
No, he did not. And
why would they put
Why
would they put a minister into a Chinese church who didn't speak Chinese?
Well, that's a very good question. It really strikes to what is the true intent of the Christian Missionary Alliance. If their true intent was to help them get back on their feet and help them grow, he would have got their materials translated into Chinese for them. They would have had a Chinese speaking pastor, but he refused to give them one.
Now, basically, have you contacted at all the minister who's in Florida, I guess it is, the one who was there before, and get his take on what's going on? Has anybody talked to him?
I have not talked to him, but the members of the Chinese church have talked to him, and he didn't want to actually leave, but he was told. In fact, I've gotten this from other churches, not just Chinese churches in the CMA, where they were told if they didn't go along with See, they wanted to grow the church with the English-speaking Chinese because there's not enough of the the people that speak Chinese that don't speak English in order for the church to grow. So he was told that he would be having to find another job within within a year, I think was the time, and he was not, of course, able to do that. And so they got him a job down in Florida, which I can't figure out why they'd give him a job down there if the agenda is that he wouldn't fulfill the requirements down there any better than he would in Colorado.
Well, so
it's really fishy.
Well, basically, wasn't he doing a good job in Colorado? What was wrong with what was happening in Colorado?
Well, he was doing a great job if you were to ask the members of the Chinese church. That pretty well.
Well, wasn't making enough money, was that it, or what was it?
The church was not growing fast enough, and part of that was due to there was a great downturn in the economy, and Colorado Springs is a high-tech industry, and there's a high percentage of people in the Chinese community that work in high-tech. And so when the economy took a downturn, particularly in high-tech, those Chinese people had to leave to go to other states to get jobs. So they lost a lot of their members due to that, but that wasn't from any moral lapse or reasons of that should be punished, because the church should also be punished then because their church got smaller. If the church had been growing, at least allegedly, they would not have had closed their church down and sold the property. But I wanted to I'll just answer to your question. From 1991 to 2006, the Chinese had three pastors, one who led the congregation before its affiliation with the Alliance, subsequently became an Alliance-ordained pastor who was not an Alliance, one that was not ordained, and then one who was hired by the Chinese church and later ordained and approved. So they had a pastor that was functioning perfectly fine for that season. But as soon as the property was paid off, the deed was all of a sudden they're not complying with these regulations that they're supposed to follow. As soon as the building is paid off, all of a sudden they're not complying. Sorry to interrupt it, but just so you know, what they filed in the claim, they've got a list. It's an 18-page. You can probably, if anybody was interested in getting it, you could get it from the courthouse. But I can also email you the actual the filing under the second claim as a civil conspiracy, a breach of fiduciary duty. The conversion, which is it's an accounting term, is where they take assets and illegally convert them, which is what they did with their property and their assets. They don't even know where a lot of the assets are. The fourth claim was this outrageous conduct with reckless disregard of the rights and feelings of the plaintiffs. That's the Chinese people. And the fifth claim is fraud. It was where the defendants, the Chinese people, knew that, or the plaintiffs, I'm sorry, or I get the plaintiffs and defendants mixed up, they knew they were unlawfully appropriating property of the Chinese church. The defendants accomplished their deceitful act by relying on the manual, on their manual, using it as their excuse to steal the church from them.
Well, of course, did the people of the church actually sign up so that with the idea that they would be controlled from above and that they would no longer own the property, even though they'd bought and paid for it? Did they really understand that, according to this hierarchical scheme, that the central authority could take their property from them any time they wanted?
A few people knew, and some that aren't there anymore earlier on, but most of the people, according to Keith Wong, who's the the contact person on the press release, which you can see when you, if you go to the website, if you want to call him and email him, you can ask your questions you might have. They're having to raise money for their legal expenses because guess who took all their money? So the CMA must be figuring, well, if I clean them out, they won't have any money to fight us. So they, in the sixth claimant, they have the civil theft, which was the property, and they go on. That I don't want to belabor you with all of this, but it's a very detailed report that was prepared in the lawsuit, and I'm not sure when the court date is on it. But the defendant, once again, they're filing a lawsuit against the Mid-America District of the Christian Missionary Alliance, as well as the headquarters of the Missionary Alliance Church, Randy Esberg, who's the district superintendent for that Mid-America District, and Robert Trempert, who's pastor of another church there in Colorado Springs.
Well, of course, these would not be the defendants, James. These would be the plaintiffs against the defendants. And the
But the Christian Missionary Alliance is not suing the local church. That often happens. This case is the local church is filing suit.
Then they become the defendants against. They become the plaintiffs, and the defendants would be the Missionary Alliance.
Right. In this case, it's the plaintiffs are actually the people that are filing the suit.
All right. Fine. Would you like to get your web page out there so people would know how to reach you?
Yes. I will tell you, first the easiest way to get there is just type my name under your Google search engine. Just type my name, James, the last name, SUNDQUIST, and I'll be the top website. For those of you who want to just type the URL in right away, it's after the W's, it's .abrahamic-faith.com/false. And then spell false with a capital F, hyphen teachers, spell teachers with a capital T, .html. I'll repeat it again, abrahamic-faith.com/false-teachers.html.
Because now, James, you have taken quite a courageous position against this major movement in Christendom today, which is the church growth movement, the purpose-driven church. Have you come under personal attack for doing this?
You're not going to believe how much attack. I've gotten, since my first book, I've gotten a host of SOS calls around the world, from all over Africa, the Netherlands, New Zealand, from Canada, all of the United States, well, not every country in the world, but a lot of countries, that have had this happened to them, and they've asked for counsel. There are different stages of what's happened to their church. Either just came there and help, what do we do, or it's further down the road, and what do they do now? And so I've been able to give them comfort and encouragement, and then help them give them. They use my PowerPoint slideshow if they want to, which is available online, and anyone can use it at no charge. And some of the attacks I get, and one more recently, is that I'm doing this for the money. And I have I've waived the royalties on my book, and I hope you get some of my... You offer my first book...
Yes, we do. We carry your first book. I don't know why we don't carry your second one.
Well, you can... Southwest Radio is my publisher. Well,
right.
Be happy to supply with Rick Warren's Global Peace Plan versus Scripture. And I had already been discussing what the Christian Missionary Alliance was doing long before this. I found about this Chinese church whose property was seized. Because what normally happens, it doesn't get that far, Dr. Stan. Usually the church is intimidated into complying with these transformation of their church, and a close family of relative of mine, very close, they seized, hijacked their church, and they were told if they didn't go along with the transformation of this church and all of these things that they're changing, that they would exercise Titus 3:15, and they'd give them a second warning, and if they didn't comply, they'd expel them from the church. So what ends up happening, Dr. Stan, is that a lot of people stay and they just cow under and toe the mark. Then some make some waves, and before they exercise Titus 15, they make a commotion and confront the leaders that this is unbiblical, including another medical doctor that was up at this one church, in CMA Church in New York State. And then they have several meetings, and they confront them and say, this is not biblical, and they're just told that that's too bad, this is what we're going to do. And then they had a meeting, a congregational meeting, and they said, okay, you can voice your opinions, but you really have no voice because we're elder-ruled, and our elders have ruled that this is what we're going to do. We're going to do the purpose-driven transformation of this church and these other principles. So a lot of them leave. And then what happened at this family member's church, then within the last year, there was a second split where a bunch of people woke up, and two of their top elders then resigned and have left. They booted the choir director out, and so they lost the whole choir, and the choir went to another church. And this all could have been prevented had they just not brought in this purpose-driven plague in the first place. But anyway, it never got to the point of exercising the reversionary clause, because they were able to get the church enough people to go along with this. The rest would leave, so that it never got to the point where it got to a lawsuit of either the church saying you can't take our property and do this to it, or so that they never got as far as the actual lawsuit filing. Although when the word gets out about this, it's a lot of people might say, wake up and smell the coffee, and start forming a class action lawsuit to get their church property back. And the reason I think that they're entitled to do this is that it is true the scripture says you're to not bring your brother to court, but if crimes are committed, that you're compelled to tell the authorities. But number two, we're called to be good stewards, and you know the talents parable where God gives you 2 or 3 or 10 talents, and when he comes back, how many did you have? And you tell him, well, you gave me 3, Lord, but now I have 0. And the Lord says, well, how come you have 0 and when I gave you 3? I called you to be a good steward of the resources I gave you. So what happened to them? And he said, well, they decided to just steal my church, and I just let them because I thought your scripture said if they ask for your coat, give them your coat. So they wanted our church, so I just gave it over to them. But I believe that the Lord would say, well, you're supposed to be a steward. That's a public trust. A church is for the public and the public's well-being, and that you are just like a police officer is there to protect the people from malefactors, and so the courts can be used as an instrument for the law to defend the community, and so the people have a right to stand up and to fight for their property. By that, I don't mean they have to, pull guns and things, but I mean to use the courts as an instrument of authority that Paul sets up in Romans in order to rightfully secure their property in order to not have it be apostatized. Don't you think, Dr. Stan? Right. You don't have to answer, because I'm just telling you that's my view, and like you say, it's not necessarily the views of the station.
Well, I think that what the tragedy is, of course, that we see this centralized authority, this effort to transform the Christian church today. And when Time magazine picked Rick Warren as America's minister, the leading minister in America, why, of course, you know that he has sold his soul to the Council on Foreign Relations, the elite who want the one world religion. And really, this is in many respects what they're doing. They're creating a one world religion where we can all work together. Well, I don't think that God wanted that. I think that he has a lot of denominations within the Protestant church because he doesn't want total uniformity. there's uniformity in belief, but not in structure. And, of course, what they really want to do is unite the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church and the Muslim Church and the Hindu Church and the Shinto and all of the various religions of the world into this one world religion. And, of course, this goes right along with the ancient Luciferian plan for the one world government, the one world religion, the one world leader. And we live at one of the most exciting times in the world because you can see these things coming together. Of course, James is out there trying to speak against them and in contact with people. And certainly this is happening not simply in the Chinese church in Colorado Springs, but all across the country and in various denominations. I know I've talked to Presbyterians who did not like what was happening and certainly wanted to withdraw, and they lost their church, happening in the Episcopalians. Oh, you don't want to ordain women and marry homosexuals? Well, you're going to take away your church. And so, I mean, what about individual freedom under God, under Christ? Well, that, of course, is simply an idealistic concept, but the reality is it's all about control. James, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Got 3 minutes. Well, let me just say that I personally cannot finance helping these Chinese people, but I was struck with my own heart and conscience that to do what I could do for them, and I'm able to get it on the radio and write in their behalf, in their defense, and try to help them be a good watchman on the wall and to warn the rest of the church that we can't remain silent in the face of an enemy army coming into our own church to take it over, that we do need to take a stand. We can't remain silent because evil will prosper when good men do nothing. And so I encourage anyone, if they want to help out the Chinese church, that they can go to my website and see the link that take you right to the press release, which will take you right to a contact, and you can pray for them, get a hold of them, encourage them. If you want to help them with their financial needs, to help them with their suit, if the Lord leads you to do that, I highly encourage you to do that. There's nothing in this for me except to help these refugees that I just could not close up my heart and harden my heart against them. So that's what I'm doing, and I appreciate you, Dr. Stan, for having me on your show and sharing this, which is really tragic news, but it's better to know what's going on, that you might be able to do something, than to just not have it be known. And I encourage everyone to really examine their heart as well as what's going on in their church. Push comes to shove, if you lose your church, it's better to do that than lose your salvation. I encourage everyone to do that, and I hate to say this because I believe the Christian Missionary Alliance historically is as solid as you could get doctrinally. They held close to Scripture, but like the many denominations, they are going to apostate, and I have a whole long list of the false teachers that they're promoting on my website too that you can check out, and it grieves me greatly. I've had family members in it. We were in one for a while, and I've played concerts in a lot of Christian Missionary Alliance. So it gives me no great delight to have to report this, but nevertheless, I believe that it's the just thing to do. And again, I thank you for having me, Dr. Stan. Once again, if you would like to know more about this, you can go visit our website and just type my name in, James Sundquist, Sundquist, on your Google, and it'll be the top search engine. It'll be the top website.
Well, we're out of sight. Out of time. Good night. God bless.
God bless. Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest has been James Sundquist. If you'd like to know more, go to just Google in on your computer, James Sundquist, and of course, it'll take you to his website. You can find out about it. We have a 4-tape set on the church growth movement. We have a DVD done by our very good friend, Bob Klink. Dr. Bob Klink is an orthopedic surgeon, just as I was, called Diaprax. Diaprax, it really takes you into the background of this whole idea, and it is all about corporate planning. It's the same approach to religion that has been used in government, that's been used in the corporation. And it is really about a corporate plan. And, of course, the minister then becomes the corporate leader. And everybody will, of course, do what they're told to do. And then we begin to transform the music and the message of the church. It's happening all across America. So if you'd like to get our four-tape set on the Church Growth Movement, our DVD on on Diaprax, why, of course, the information is available. And if you'd like to know more, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will want to understand more about what's going on. And that's why my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, is so important. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. And my more recent talk, entitled The Forbidden Secret. The Forbidden Secret, and we recommend these to you. And The Forbidden Secret does come with a syllabus. You need to understand what is happening in the church today. We are under attack from within. And of course, we have a four-tape, a four-CD set called The Secret, Behind the Secret. We have a very, very professionally done DVD called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and the second in the series, that same series called Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, where you'll see portraits and, of course, images carved in stone and statues that you might pass by and not understand, but they all have an occultic foundation. And many of them date back to the formation of America, because at the time America was founded, even though we were predominantly a Christian nation, the occultists were there. And there is a master plan. It has always been to use the financial and military power of the United States to bring about this one world religion, one world government. Sydney, if you have not yet seen the DVD that we produced with Chris Pinto, called the New Atlantis, and what is the New Atlantis? Well, America is the New Atlantis, I think it's titled The Atlantis Connection, because it has been the dream of the occultists down through the ages that America would become the New Atlantis and would lead the people into this world government. And then, of course, the DVD we have with Constance Cumby about the emergence, and that's about the coming world leader. That's the Emergence by Constance Cumby, the coming world leader. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set with Constance Cumby, whose name escapes me at the moment. But all you have to do is ask for the four-tape set on Constance Cumby, or four-CD set. And she brought out so many very, very important things to understand that there is another movement in the world that most people don't understand. It permeates our political system. It permeates our educational system. It permeates our financial system. It permeates every aspect of our lives, and it is a spiritual force, and it is a very dark spiritual force. And many of the people who are part of this movement worship another god, for this is the modern day manifestation of Gnosticism. And this idea that there really are two gods, one is the god that the Christians worship, and the other is the true God. And, of course, that is the Prince of Darkness, who was cast out of heaven because he would be as God. But they think that he is the right God. He is the true God, and that we worship the wrong God. And if they get in touch with him, through being a medium or fortune teller, diviner, or certainly through witchcraft, they can develop all sorts of tremendous power, but at the price of their eternal souls.